So I would really like to thank Cecile Oxal and the Hull Amnesty International Group for inviting me to give this talk to accompany the exhibition here in the Hull History Centre. The exhibition is based on a great deal of work by Cecile Oxal, and I'd really like to congratulate her on achieving a fascinating, detailed and really accessible exhibition which gives a very rich account of the activities of Dr. Mary Murdoch. And her campaigning for women's suffrage and her involvement in the city of Hull. So this is a little outline of what I want to present today. In this talk, I want to explore Mary Murdoch's role as a doctor in the campaign for women's suffrage and in the reforms in education and healthcare in Hull. Her medical practice extended in the region as far as Grimsby. She was known nationally and internationally, lecturing in the UK, Canada, the Netherlands, and even in Italy. But in order to understand Dr. Mary Murdoch's work in the political context of the time, I'm going to briefly describe the main arguments for and against women's suffrage. This will provide a perspective on Mary Murdoch's campaign about housing conditions in Hull and her interest in Hull. In childcare in Hull and elsewhere. Why was being a doctor, being really committed to social reforms about housing and childcare, so politically significant in this period? So finally, I'm going to consider Mary Murdoch's very modern approach to medical treatment and some of her hints for medical students given in a lecture in 1904. In Hull, she was a very well-respected figure as the city's first female GP. She was also very identifiable in public. As the first woman in Hull to drive her own car, she always did so by exceeding the speed limit. One man from Hull recalled, "No, Dr. Murdoch, she nearly killed me 3 times with her motor." So the numerous crashes and near misses did not seem to deter her, but the trusty vehicle was put to good use when she had to get to patients in an emergency. So she'd used a horse and carriage, she'd used a bicycle in the middle of the night, and then when cars were available, she seized the moment. So I just want to begin with a note on sources. One of the many projects to celebrate the cultural heritage of Hull for the City of Culture Year is to add biographical entries in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. This huge reference work began as a book in 1885, and it was edited by Virginia Woolf's father, Leslie Stephen. In 2004, the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography extended its remit to include more people, and certain entries were also revised and updated. It now has over 60,000 entries, and of course it's also available online by subscription. So it's fast.
And here at the History Centre,
Catherine. And here at the... Brilliant. So after this talk, we'll go search it online. But the exciting thing was that Dr. Mary Murdoch was included in this 2004 inclusion of more people. So I was commissioned to write the essay by Brian Harrison at the DNB. I was in Hull, and it was, you know, my connection with women's suffrage history seemed to make sense to, I think, ask me to do it. And I have to admit, I hadn't heard of Mary Murdoch. When I looked into the published sources, I discovered that she had featured in Olive Banks's very influential Biographical Dictionary of British Feminists, 1985 to 1990, but 3 years after her death in 1919, Hope Mallison published a biography, and it was drawn on letters and recollections from friends, and this is the real source of information we've got about Mary Murdoch, apart from all the newspapers of the day which covered lots of her activities. So this is the major source, I think. But Dr. Louisa Martindale also wrote an autobiography, and she writes a chapter about Mary Murdoch in that. Now, Malleson's biography provides a very detailed account right from the beginning in Scotland. Mary Murdoch was from Elgin, her childhood days, her family circumstances, and then her career and time in Hull. Her father was a solicitor. He died when she was quite young. She had several brothers and sisters. The brothers were very sort of far-flung. Somebody, one of them in Ceylon, was a naval surgeon. Her two sisters got married, following convention and expectations, but Mary Murdoch always regarded marriage in terms of a woman giving up her liberty. Instead, she used money inherited from her mother to fund her medical education at the London School of Medicine for Women in 1888 to 92. Now, the medical profession was opening up to women at this time, but there had been considerable opposition. In Edinburgh in 1869, women had been allowed to sit exams. And I think they thought that that would sort of pacify these women interested in medicine and they wouldn't kind of do anything with it. Of course, rather annoyingly, one of them won a scholarship in chemistry and then several others wanted to get clinical training. And so this led to quite a lot of resistance, and there was actually a riot of male students, and the female medical students were really kind of, you know, abused in all sorts of ways, and this didn't deter them. However, in 1873, the examinations were closed to women, so there was a little opening, and then it was kind of closed down again. There were these seven women pioneering medical students in Edinburgh, included Sophia Jex Blake, and she completed her medical training in Switzerland and then founded the London School of Medicine for Women in 1874. This was a really important moment, and this is where Mary Murdoch trained. So I think the determination by women to fight for university education was clearly signalling women's equality and independence, but it was also politically significant in other ways. Science and medical knowledge about contraception and sexually transmitted diseases had devastating effects. This information was controlled, and women didn't have easy access to this. So, reflecting on women's suffrage, the release of a new film, Suffragette, marks the heightened interest in this period of women's history. The women's suffrage political campaigns are being rediscovered because they resonate with many people today. Women's suffrage activists were notable for their use of spectacular and creative ways of capturing attention and persuading an audience. Protesting in public, they organised processions and marches. And the exhibition here refers to women of Hull taking part in some of these. Some activists became frustrated by the lack of results after such an extensive period of peaceful forms of protest, writing letters, lobbying MPs through the second half of the 19th century. In the early 20th century, the Women's Social and Political Union was formed. And by 1905, they were adopting militant methods, disrupting political meetings, and they were prepared to break the law in quite a number of different ways that we're familiar with, really. Law-breaking actions, destruction of property, and hunger striking. These more militant methods were associated with the suffragettes, whereas the more law-abiding lobbying activists who carried on were called suffragists. So there was a kind of decision to be made about what strategy you were prepared to take and which might be more effective. Many organisations were formed to campaign, and some of these were associated with different fields of work. The Women Writers Suffrage League organised female authors who wrote short stories and novels and plays and poetry about the arguments for women's suffrage. The Actresses Franchise League involved female performers and playwrights who wrote plays and performed them to campaign for the movement. It was a real renaissance of women's writing. There are many, many plays and short stories and poems written by somebody who might only just have written that one thing, but they were roused to do it because they wanted to campaign for the vote for women. So where did Mary Murdoch stand on the question of militancy? So she founded the National Union of Women's Suffrage Society's Hull branch here, and they were suffragist, constitutional. However, in 1911, when the NUWSS distanced itself from and publicly condemned the militant WSPU, Mary Murdoch apparently resigned, and she regarded it as an act of disloyalty to speak out in public against others who were campaigning for the same goal. So she had a real sense of loyalty and integrity. And she apparently joined the WSPU, the suffragettes. But she didn't engage in acts of militancy herself. And I think this has really made me think about sort of the critical orthodoxy, the way we tend to think about the suffragettes and the suffragists, and this decision about strategy, that people took one side or another. But it was actually a really difficult decision to make. And there's actually another organisation that quite often gets missed out of the discussion, which is the Women's Freedom League. And they were formed in 1907. And they were a breakaway group from the suffragettes. And they objected to the autocratic methods of the Pankhursts. And the Women's Freedom League were prepared to break the law, but they objected to the destruction of property and the kind of dangerous destructiveness of some of the actions of the suffragettes. So Women's Freedom League were interested in publicity stunts. Muriel Matters went up in a hot air balloon over London, scattered leaflets. There was the chaining of women to the grill in the Strangers Gallery in the House of Commons. So they did things that were really spectacular. They weren't always within the law. There were cultural kind of interventions, but different from the WSPU. So I was wondering, this is kind of new research for me, I've just been preparing for this lecture, revising what I thought about Mary Murdoch. Was she in the Women's Freedom League? And was the Women's Freedom League active in Hull? So I found out some interesting things about this. So apparently the Women's Freedom League wasn't particularly active in the north, in the northeast. And however, Mary Murdoch gave a public speech on behalf of Mrs. Despard. This is transcribed in the Hope Mallison biography. And she says, I'm speaking on behalf of Mrs. Despard. Mrs. Despard is the president of the Women's Freedom League. So that speech doesn't seem to be dated, so I'll need to track that down. So very interesting where she stood on this. And she said, both my voice and my purse are at the service of the movement. She was absolutely committed to it. But I think it was in her daily work that she actively fought for equality, displaying profound bravery, and she used every opportunity to educate people about the need for change, including extending the vote to women. So the arguments for and against women's suffrage helped to make sense of the way in which Mary Murdoch's medical work, her interventions about standards of housing, and campaigns about childcare all come together. They all relate to the political movement for women's enfranchisement. Arguments for women and men to be treated equally were encountered by arguments that women and men were fundamentally different, and therefore equality didn't really come into it. There are three arguments, broadly speaking. The separate spheres ideology. It related to women having access to the domestic sphere of childcare and keeping the home for the husband. And the public sphere was regarded as the domain of men, the political public sphere. And so the idea was that women's proper place in the home was dealing with cleaning, cooking, and childcare, And it was the men who would occupy the public sphere of work and politics. And the consequence of giving the vote to women would be chaos. It would be chaos in the home. There would be neglected families and abandoned babies. This is such an emotive image. Mummy's a suffragette. You know, it reaches out to us, doesn't it? Now, the pro-suffrage campaign, some of these images are very kind of fluid and volatile, so very similar images and arguments were used on both sides for different purposes. So here we have, I think, a pro-suffrage response. We want our vote. So babies would suffer unless women had the vote. Mary Murdoch believed this. You know, she was committed to this position. Now, secondly, there are a whole load of biological arguments around sexual difference, which were proposed, they were endorsed, they were supported by scientists and medical men to argue that women were unsuitable to have the vote, the responsibility of the vote, because of being intellectually inferior, brains less developed than men. Charles Darwin's ideas about the development of the species were brought in here, and the woman was, you know, further down the line than the evolutionary tree, as it were. And also, there were sort of allusions to, references to menstruation and kind of monthly, kind of erratic behaviour, instability. So the idea that, you know, women were simply not trusted with the, should not be trusted with the vote. And the conclusion was that men and women, fundamentally different, and therefore not equal. And the idea that a complementarity was required, that men and women different, and that men should be in charge of the political sphere and the voting because they were naturally equipped to deal with it responsibly. The physical force argument here is a really important and powerful one at the time. So it was claimed that citizens must be able to defend the country in time of war. Physical strength is therefore a necessary criterion for citizenship. Women were excluded from the military forces. This is why when the war breaks out, the militants are all kind of going out to be ambulance drivers. And they want to get as near as they can to the war zone because they're proving their ability to defend the country in time of war. They are militants. And they refer to this, you know, the World War. And before that, it was the war against women. They're going to fight to be in that front line as near as they can be because they're proving their physical prowess. Female heroism becomes very important. Physical trial and self-sacrifice. The hunger strikes were crucial here. People were prepared to lose their lives for this political campaign. Civil disobedience, but it was demonstrated by physical strength and endurance. There was somebody called Mrs. Garrard who would appear at women's suffrage political events, which were like festivals. There would be stalls with women's suffrage hats and teacups and jewellery and whatnot. And there would be Mrs. Garrard demonstrating martial arts. So women were learning self-defence because when they went out into the street to be public speakers, they risked assault. And some of this was actually promoted, it was endorsed by the police force, unfortunately. So there are, you know, evidence of really violent clashes and also evidence of references to what was probably indecent assault. So Mary Richardson, who slashed the painting, the Rokeby Venus, famously, her autobiography is very, very interesting. When, as soon as she attacked the painting, the very polite tourists with their Baedeker guides standing nearby suddenly erupted in a storm of violence and attacked her. The violent act then led to more violence. But she also refers later on in her autobiography to the expenses incurred in being a suffragette because of your clothes being torn. This was a little reference that for me was very telling, that to be out in public, politically active, defending, arguing for the right to vote, it incurred, you know, physical danger. There were costs here, and it was, you know, very brave, I think, for them to take this action. So Dr. Mary Murdoch's work in Hull. She didn't have time for the more spectacular publicity stunts. I spent a lot of time researching women's suffrage theatre and the literature of the women's suffrage movement and the posters and the cultural activities. And reading now again about Mary Murdoch, I'm getting a bit of a different view of that, because you had to have time to be writing a play and to be writing a poem and a novel, or organising a play, or painting a picture which turned into a poster. But Mary Murdoch didn't have time, because every waking hour she was committed to sorting out the health of the people of Hull. And she was very concerned about areas of social reform that now are known as social work and public health. Mm. So she was a doctor, but she took all of these other things into her remit. She saw that there was much to be done, not only to improve opportunities for women, but to enhance the health and life expectancy of women and children. And I've got two references that are important here, I think. Josephine Butler, in the 1860s, is organising campaigns against legislation called the Contagious Diseases Acts, which were all to do with controlling prostitution. Particularly, the military personnel in Britain were becoming ill as a result of sexually transmitted diseases. The solution at the time was not to educate people about sexually transmitted diseases. It was about controlling the diseased female bodies. And Josephine Butler made a very important sort of shift in thinking, because she saw this as implicating all women. If you were found in a part of a city which was associated with prostitution, just because you're a woman in that part of the city, you could be arrested and you could be forcibly examined. And she wrote about this, she campaigned about it, and she organised other women. So it's a kind of feminist moment where she's kind of seeing the lot of the prostitute as allied to the fate of all women in terms of rights. So it's a very, very important moment in history. Christabel Pankhurst writes about sexually transmitted diseases in The Great Scourge and How to End It, and her statistics in this pamphlet have been questioned. However, they've also been defended, and it was kind of a really, really serious problem. And Mary Murdoch was dealing with these sorts of issues and also seeing them as part of her problem, part of everybody's problem. It was devastating. Sylvia Pankhurst in the East End of London sets up the Mother's Arms. It's such a brilliant name. And it was a kind of creche, and they had a sort of a kitchen for working people. She also, like Mary Murdoch, understood the real kind of needs of people and what politics should really be about. So my point at the bottom of this slide, as you can see at the back, is who could afford to risk imprisonment and lose their livelihood, home and children. So the strategies around women's suffrage campaigning really needed to address this and think about it. So Mary Murdoch comes to Hull in 1893. She's house surgeon at the Victoria Hospital for Children in Park Street. And she goes away, trains elsewhere for a bit, and then she comes back. in 1896, and she stays here. She was honorary assistant physician. Her CV is amazing. You know, she organized a school for mothers, a creche, a girls' patriotic club, and a lodging house for women in Lister Street. So these facilities were influenced by the latest thinking at the time. In France, there was a movement to educate parents, mothers and fathers, on the rearing of children. So Mary Murdoch was at the forefront of thinking about medicine, public health and education. She was officially acknowledged. So in 1909, she was elected vice president of the East Yorkshire, Nottinghamshire and Lincoln branch of the British Medical Association, 1909. This is a really important fact about Mary Murdoch. So this was around the time that the hunger striking, the force feeding was kind of taking place. Mary Murdoch is being honoured and respected by her profession, which is mainly made up of male doctors. You know, this is really important. Now, Mary Murdoch's practical work and interventions to help working class women and families were understood as political acts. Some of the women's suffrage posters acknowledged social class as an often unspoken conflict when the comfortable women ignored the burdens of working class women. For Mary Murdoch, the situation of working class women and children was her principal concern. She wrote about her approach to advising and treating unmarried girls who were pregnant. "I keep a specially warm corner in my heart for all illegitimate children," she writes. "And when girls come to me, when they have gone wrong, I am so abominably gentle with them that it almost amounts to a fault. My heart just contracts up with pain when I have to tell them, and I always help them through and tell their mothers for them. In a case I have just had, it nearly broke the father's and mother's hearts. I set them to work on practical details, made them take her to a nice home for the confinement and find a home for the baby, because the girl has to work." There's no conventional moral condemnation or demonisation from Murdoch here, but she acknowledges her own empathy as approaching what might be considered by others as a fault. The terminology there is fascinating. Murdoch aligns herself with the young mother who had gone wrong, unconsciously, I would suggest. Murdoch's automatic response was always to understand and treat with compassion. She took seriously what has become known as bedside manner and the beneficial effects of a calm and positive demeanour. This is what we want in our doctors, isn't it? "It's a doctor's business to take away pain. It has often been my privilege to remove the look of trouble from people's eyes. I can but go on inspiring her," a patient, "with hope every day, and that goes such a long way towards ultimate recovery. It is my only trick as a doctor." So practicing medicine, the patient and the community. Mary Murdoch's work as a doctor in Hull involved a tireless commitment to her patients and the community. She did not see her patients as a bundle of symptoms. They had full lives, families, home and work, and their proper treatment necessarily involved a thorough understanding of the factors which influence good and poor health. It was in this context that Mary Murdoch became involved in public speaking on the topic of housing in Hull, and she really kicked up a storm. In 1911, she spoke at a conference in Glasgow organised by the National Union of Women Workers. Although the statistics she cited had already been published in a Fabian Society pamphlet about housing in Hull, her talk created a scandal. She argued that half of the housing in Hull was insanitary, overcrowded and detrimental to health, and there were even cases of children of 5 and 7 years old with venereal diseases. The city council and landlords in Hull protested forcefully, condemning Murdoch and rejecting her evidence but she stood her ground, and ultimately change was set in motion. It was particularly the time and effort she spent on her visits to patients which are remembered in those who contributed to Hope Mallison's biography. Perhaps this bedside manner, it's a rather prosaic term, covers what is described in some of these letters and testimonies about her interactions with patients and what she thought was important in their treatment. She understood the emotional and psychological context of healing in a way which seems to be very modern and perhaps taken for granted by patients today as an ideal. And it becomes very apparent when a doctor is impatient or indifferent to one's suffering. One of Murdoch's friends noted, "One of the most wonderful gifts in her was that extraordinary capacity for always appearing to have plenty of time." Murdoch went beyond the expectations of the role of a doctor, seeing her patients in their home environment and communities. It was patient-centred in its approach, and in an age before social services and specialisms of today, Murdoch regarded it as her duty to stay with dying patients. One trip home was potentially to be delayed by her commitment to an elderly patient, so she was going to travel a long way home to see her family, and she had to postpone it. "Today, her heart is failing, and I am visiting every 4 hours. If she dies, I shall be free. If she lingers, I cannot leave Hull. I am much disappointed, but of course, my beloved profession leaves me open to all sorts of predicaments of this kind." A friend recalled her sympathy with Murdoch on her views about the lack of protection and appropriate education for disabled children who were expected to be sent out to earn their living in service. In a lecture in October 1904 in Hints for Medical Students, Mary Murdoch returned to the London School of Medicine for Women to give a lecture to a new cohort of female students. And this is transcribed in the Hope Mallison biography. It's really interesting. And the lecture provides three types of hints: material, mental, and ethical. And the material hints are fascinating because it's all about the doctors, the medical students, looking after their own health, because they won't be able to do their job unless they do that. So she advocates sleep. She slept, you know, about 4 hours or 5 hours or something a night. Personal hygiene, clothes, taking care of clothes, food, fresh air, exercise, study and relaxation. But the way she describes these things, quite fascinating. The mental hints concerned the recommendation to belong to a debating society or a suffrage society. She just takes this for granted that young female doctors will go out and join the suffrage movement. Now, the testimonies and legacy that we have about Murdoch, some of them come from Dr. Louisa Martindale, and she recalled that Mary Murdoch would think nothing of going to the docks in Hull, standing on an upturned box, and recommending that the men spend a couple of hours every Sunday holding their babies. And we've seen the images earlier on of "Who'll mind the baby? Mummy's a suffragette." The idea that men in this period would be involved in childcare is so controversial. It's received as a real kind of threat. It's really emasculating. But she was prepared to advocate this in Hull, on the docks, on an upturned box. And she won people over. And what she was also thinking of was giving the women a bit of spare breathing space, that actually this should be a job for everybody. But it's very, very controversial. So she didn't just have this view, express it to her friends, she spoke it in public. Now, the recollections that Hope Mallison had collected in this book, including an irate husband who said, "Before Dr. Murdoch came bothering round, I had an obedient household. My wife and daughters obeyed me in every way." But now, one has gone to be, I think that's actually a nurse in the infirmary. Another man I mentioned at the beginning recalled her, "No, Dr. Murdoch, she nearly killed me three times with her motor." So Dr. Mary Murdoch has left a lasting legacy. In 2011, I organised the production of a women's suffrage play, A Pageant of Great Women, and it was directed by Anna Birch, who I collaborate with on research on this play. And it's put on at the University of Hull, and we added four local women, including Mary Murdoch. Now, what can we learn from Mary Murdoch? She argued for the need for and the connectedness of healthcare, social care, housing and childcare. She advocated for the importance of education and training for women. And in her own practice, she followed this approach. She trained Dr. Louisa Martindale, who is really famous in the history of medicine. Mary Murdoch was a brave advocate for change. She was always prepared to speak out. She believed in the central role of the doctor in the community. She had very modern ideas. She recommended that the medical students take care of their own health, and her description of relaxation really sounds like meditation. It sounds like mindfulness. You know, and her holidays were spent, she cycled something like 240 miles. You know, this was her idea. On bicycles of that period, it'd be very, very uncomfortable. But she went on massive bike rides across Europe. And so her holidays were kind of equally kind of active. But she also describes just sort of, you know, lying on a moor, looking up at the sky. And it's about meditation, about clearing your head. Mm. You know, very modern. She also urges the female medical students to avoid cheap clothes. This is what we're saying today about modern slavery. Never buy in a cheap market, because it means your clothes have cost human lives in the making. She said this. So the reaction of the people of Hull to her untimely death in 1916, she went out in the snow to see a patient and she got drenched and she was exhausted and she had an ulcer, gastric ulcer throughout her life, and you know, periods of near-death experience with this awful health condition she had. But she put herself under so much pressure, and the people of Hull came out in droves for her funeral, and her distinctive car was driven at the funeral at an uncharacteristically slow speed. It's probably the only time that car obeyed the speed limit. But it was noted that she captured the heart of the city, and I think that really sort of sums her up. Thank you.